How's everybody out there?
Everybody in here is great. How's everybody out there?
I'm doing okay. It has been a really hard month this week.
Well said.
Well, we have, it's been more than a week since we've recorded. I believe that we put up our episode regarding 16 Psyche last episode. Didn't get a whole lot of feedback on it, but we got a handful of feedback. What was your feelings and responses, I guess, to last week's episode of those that gave you feedback?
I can't help but think that people are just stunned with the brilliance of the idea, actually. I think that the project is probably well underway at NASA. I feel like they've reevaluated their entire plan for the 2030s, and I think things are going to be great. Looking at a bright future.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, I do think it's a good idea. I think like with any big idea, that big, I think sometimes it takes a little bit to understand and grasp the fullness of it necessarily.
A little funny aside on that point, I actually had a mini debate with ChatGPT over it.
Yeah.
I was like plugging some of the numbers back in. I'm just like, maybe I should check this and make sure that I got these numbers right and that I'm not missing something. And then it started to tell me why it wasn't a great return on the investment. And I was like, but I think you're leaving out these things. And it was like, oh, good point. Factoring those in, yes, this could be a future changing event. And I was like, oh, okay.
Thanks. It is one of the things I actually appreciate, about AI over, and this might be nostalgic for you. It was very nostalgic for me. I saw this on Reddit this week. Somebody mentioned Smarter Child. Do you remember Smarter Child from AOL Instant Messenger?
I don't.
So it was essentially just pre-programmed with responses, but it was the first like virtual friend that you could add inside of AOL Instant Messenger. And it gave a collection of pre-programmed responses and I guess reacted accordingly to like trigger words. Not exactly sure what, but one of the things I think I genuinely appreciate about modern AI and specifically the ones that I use are Gemini, Claude, and I avoid ChatGPT like the plague. But having released Deep Research model this week, I have been interested, but have not yet opened that browser up. I've been trying to generally avoid the services that supported the current guy on the main stage, and especially not Grok, in solidarity with my friends. But I am interested to check it out. I have looked at a lot of the media coverage of those models. Anyway, point being that you can cause the model to pivot, right? Like it won't just say, oh, I'm sorry, perhaps we should talk about something else. You know, like it'll actually say, oh, I didn't really see it that way. And so it's good to have that real world and real time feedback when you say, you know, I think that it depends on what you're prioritizing and here's what I prioritized. And I think when it allows that sort of logical pivot.
Agreed. In that respect, it's already better than most people, but
yeah, right. Not a whole lot of people are going to be willing to take feedback. Also wanted to kind of touch base on the conversation we had last week too. After recording, we talked about that same kind of concept and that you and I both had seemingly diametrically opposed ideas on a topic, not necessary to get into the topic necessarily, but in an effort to promote discussing those sorts of ideas. Now, I will say, I think that there is a little bit of a caveat there. Like, I think that not acknowledging human beings or anything dealing with specifically human rights issues, you don't necessarily have to have a good faith conversation with people who don't support your existence. But I think it's important for people to have those conversations, because what we discovered from our conversation, why don't you sum it up a little bit about what we came out with?
So I think what we figured out was that we were using the terms or some of our background assumptions that we thought we agreed on, we thought we shared, we didn't actually share, at least to the extent that we thought. And so by correcting and clarifying some of those, specifically my background assumptions, I realized that I was using something in a certain way and I was kind of taking an approach that you weren't sharing. And so we kind of had this miscommunication happening. And we realized that once we kind of clarified some aspects of it, we actually didn't disagree as much as we thought we did, which doesn't sound like much, but that's progress.
Yeah, and I think the three things I think we identified in what causes these types of conversations were what facts we considered to be facts, right?
Right.
What were the other two?
So the other one was value judgments on like what the facts should be. So there's what the facts are, which people can disagree on, but there is a right or wrong answer about that. Then there's the things to which you're referring, the objects, you know, the things you're labeling with a certain term or name, and making sure that
let's create some sort of straw man so that we can talk about this directive relative to our straw man.
Right. So let's say you think that AI is a threat to humanity. Okay. Your background facts could be lots of different things about what AI is capable of, you know, what sorts of data it's trained on, you know, how it works, all that sort of stuff. There's a fact of the matter about that that you may or may not both be aware of. So you need to make sure that all of your facts or all of your salient facts are aligned. Then you might be describing two different things. As it turns out, a lot of people reuse, including myself, a lot of times I carelessly use the word AI or the term AI to describe something that's not actually AI at all, or most people wouldn't consider it AI. So you have to make sure your terms are applying to the same object in the world. So if we're both saying we're talking about AI, but you're talking about something very different than I'm talking about.
Yeah, like a decision engine or just a workflow process.
Exactly. Exactly. So those are the things we have to make sure. And then the values is where the real conflict usually comes from. Once you get clear about what your facts are and what you're talking about, the last thing to align is your values based on whether you think that thing is helpful or harmful or whatever else. So if it's AI, like if once we get the background facts, once we share our background facts, once we're talking about the same thing, then the question can be, is this thing helpful or harmful to humanity and why? And those are the sorts of things that you can sort out once you have the other two in line. But I think what I described it as is kind of a triangulation that you use to figure out what the disagreement actually is about. And it takes work. It takes a lot of effort to get there and being willing to engage and to keep going back over things and not giving up on the other person or on the discussion itself in order to get to the end result. So
in a lot of the same ways that I think I was able to parallel it with, you know, good, fast, and cheap. And it's the truth is, you know, they say you can only pick two, but really it's not two. It's this weird third thing that is ultimately a balance of good, fast, and cheap that everyone can align on. And the ultimate goal, I think, more so than necessarily agreeing on which one is the most important of the three, is agreeing that on this specific issue or this specific project, if we're going to use the good, fast, and cheap paradigm, it's that we all agree on the balance between good, fast, and cheap. Not necessarily that we agree that being the best is necessary or being, you know, the fastest or being the cheapest, but in how we navigate those things. And I think the values that you were talking about really helps to put that into perspective, because it's not, once we aligned on the facts, which we were not necessarily aligned on prior to, once we realized, hey, okay, now that we're aligned on these facts, I agree that these are the correct facts out there, but what I hold to be more important or what I prioritize in that is, you know, in your example of AI, like I prioritize the ability for human beings to enjoy their lives in, you know, is a large factor that could be taken into account. And for me, more important necessarily than who is the person that controls the infrastructure of the AI, or what's the name of the company that controls the AI.
Right. It's power, you know, like if we may be talking about the same thing and the AI is very powerful, but if we're saying if for you, you're focusing on the value that powerful AI enables people to do things that they couldn't otherwise do, and I'm focused on the power being potentially used for harm. Both of those things can be true about the world. You know, those are not current facts necessarily. We may be discussing future potential, but the reality is we have different value alignments. And so having powerful AI as an aid to humanity might be higher on your value list than for me having technology, you know, rampant technology on the loose. Again, right. This is just hypothetical because I tend to be more
AI optimist. These are not our opinions.
Right.
About this topic. We were talking about a different topic altogether. We both felt like it was important to point out that the initially, I mean, we respected each other. We're good friends outside of, you know, podcasts and things. So we gave each other a lot of the human space to go, hey, look, I hear you. I'm just not on the same page. We can agree to disagree. That's fine. But we kept talking about it anyway, because it's on the forefronts of our mind. And as we kept talking about it, we were able to extrapolate a little bit more. And what we ultimately found was, even though we were using different words, that we disagreed on the words, we underlying had the same values and were trying to achieve the same result. And I think that that is pretty much one-to-one on what we're trying to do here. We're trying to help to kind of wade through the dictionary definitions of words and create a unified platform for understanding of the facts and how we understand them. And, you know, ultimately we're going to leave the values up to each individual, but pointing out the facts in the sense that facts matter, facts are important. And the fact that we're aligned on those facts is ultimately detrimental to the outcome of our actions that we base those, or the facts that we base those actions on.
Agreed. I think that it's important that we, as we mentioned, like we kind of went through it quickly there. You said it, but I want to say it again. The point that's most important here, perhaps, is that we gave each other the space to develop our thoughts, and we didn't take an uncharitable interpretation of the other person or straw man them. You know, we didn't use, argument tactics or, you know, anything like that. We just engaged and we tried our best to understand the other person's position and understand how they could have reached that conclusion. And in so doing, kind of, at least for me, I clarified some things in my own position. So yeah, I hope we offer that to our audience as well, or to any potential future guests. If anybody wants to come on and explain why they disagree with something that we say, you know, I would certainly offer the possibility or offer them the option to come and dialogue with us. If we're all doing it in the same spirit, I think we could all stand to learn from each other.
Yeah, and I've reached out to two individuals that I've asked to consider coming and discussing some their viewpoints and stuff on the show. And hopefully we're going to have some guests here soon that we could kind of talk about, and people who are experts in their fields, or at least really good at building communities and building organizations that are action oriented and focused around making positive changes within their community and within their world. So be sure to be on the lookout for that.
Hopefully they'll come on soon, because, you know, otherwise I'll have to start doing accents and impressions and pretending to be other people.
Yeah, well, you know, we can only...
an early morning comedy show and radio show.
Goodness. It somewhat reminds me of that Saturday Night Live movie that just recently came out. I think it's available on Netflix. It was just a variety show, you know, Live From Here, I think, was originally the name of it.
Right.
We'll have to end up doing some Live From Here stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm not much of a juggler these days, nor is podcasting audio only very conducive to juggling.
No.
So,
no.
Anyway,
don't make a struggle. Please come.
Anything that's been on your mind in world events or in national events or anything like that recently that you think is worthy of discussion or bringing out there into the world?
We mentioned, you know, deep research and just the possibilities that come about there. I mean, I don't think any one platform has necessarily cornered the market on any of this stuff, but just the idea that AI is now capable of really, like, in real time combing through articles and you know, published research and sorting it out and developing rational, you know, I mean, just the capabilities. I don't even know how to begin to describe all of them, but the capabilities are just amazing. Some of the stuff that may be on the horizon, just that's what keeps me going sometimes, is just the possibilities that are out there for us at this time. That some of them are within our grasp, it feels like.
Yeah, I think it's been really amazing to see. I'm kind of curious on your take on a trend that I noticed really pop up after the DeepSeek R1 model that was released from China, talking specifically about the information and the amalgam of sources that are used to sort of source these models, including deep research and DeepSeek and these sorts of things. Sam Altman was furious at the idea that I guess its O3 model was used in to train the DeepSeek model, which, you know, it's kind of hilarious considering he trained it on scraping the web of all of our personal content and all the opinions that we collectively have put out there into the world and books and research that essentially are sometimes copyrighted, sometimes not copyrighted. What are your takes on that? I have my own opinion that I'll share, but I was curious to get your views on that.
I have some conflicting views here, some mixed views. I don't know if I have a really coherent, consistent view.
Yeah, if you didn't, I think I would call BS, just mainly because I think it's weird. It's a weird thing. I mean, there are pluses and minuses. So let's hear your maybe inconsistent, maybe fresh off the press's views.
So I'll try to do this from the beginning, and then you just push me along if I need to move along faster, or, you know, tell me to highlight stuff or go back or whatever. I'll let you kind of speak for the audience here. So the first thing I'll point out is that the meme that you kind of, or the meme that I saw that captured the point you're making is something like, you know, they showed Sam Altman looking distraught and saying, "I stole that information fair and square." Like, you know, which is kind of like the sums it all up in one picture, right? As memes often do. But the key here, I think, is understanding what that information represents and what it doesn't represent, right? So when someone copyrights their work, they're creating ostensibly an original work, right? They're taking ideas, existing facts or stories or whatever else, and they're putting them together in a novel combination of some sort that results in adding to mankind's knowledge base, right? Is that a fair way to characterize the intellectual property part of that, or copyright, in a way that's understandable?
I don't necessarily say in the copyright space, but I would agree from an informational space. You know, I think about like Plato and a lot of our classical philosophers who essentially put their opinions out there into the world for public consumption versus trademark and copyright to be a very distinctly different mindset that only makes sense inside of capitalism. So I would say yes, mostly, but let's put an earmark or a bookmark in copyright and trademark specifically outside of that.
Okay, so let's go with just the more generic notion of an idea, right? Or information. When you gather or collect or generate information, there's a question of ownership there, right? If it's information about the world, if it's nonfiction, the facts you collect are presumably not your own facts. The facts are the world, right? They don't belong to anyone. What is just what is, right? If you have taken pains to gather some of that information or collect it and sort it into something useful for other people, now you've got something that you could claim ownership of because your work has improved or added to the knowledge base there. Is that a fair way to put it without getting into the specific legal terms?
Yeah, I mean, I think without putting it into specific legal terms, but the ownership part is the part where I feel like only needs to exist in cap within.
Okay. And that's fine. And so I think in that case, when you're looking at it from that perspective, if you take capitalism to be accidental as opposed to essential or, you know, part of the discussion, from that perspective, I mean, there's really no, if there's no ownership of information or knowledge or facts or product of an individual, at that point, then there's really nothing to stop anybody from using anything to train an AI. Right.
Agreed.
So, I mean, the only place that this discussion makes sense to have a debate or dispute about it is within the model of capitalism.
Yes. For the purpose of making money, as opposed to the purpose of generally helping humanity,
right? Which, I mean, there are carve outs within capitalism, right? Within the laws that we're talking about, which are based on capitalist principles, there are still carve outs for how you might use information that belongs to someone else or that someone else claims ownership rights over. But all that said, I mean, I guess from that perspective, if the Chinese government, the People's Republic of China, doesn't recognize the right to individual ownership of anything, then, I mean, presumably they're well within their rights to utilize anything available to them to form a basis for their own advances.
Yeah, I mean, I would mostly agree with that.
As long as you're not going to get on the world stage and then claim, well, our country can own things, even though our people can't. That's an interesting inconsistency that I think you'd have to cite there, but I think that may be the position that some would take under that approach. I don't know.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I also look at it from a technological standpoint. Like, why wouldn't I want my content to be included in, like, why wouldn't my thoughts, the things that I've created in the world, why wouldn't I want them to be a part of the collective wealth of human knowledge?
Right.
And I think the only opposition to that, well, there's two I see that are glaringly obvious. The first one being, if I use it still to make a profit or to derive a living from it, I would not want it included, because then what reason, what purpose would I have or my knowledge have to exist to enrich me? And then the other one being, if it's something that was something artistic, right? Like a song or a painting or something of that nature, I would expect to be remunerated for using my information out there in the world.
So, but aren't those part of them? And maybe this is assumed, but those are under a capitalist framework. You're talking about that, right?
Yeah, but I mean, I don't exist outside of capitalism, right? Like individually,
right? So that's what
it
I'm wondering.
It is our paradigm.
Yeah, I think we just have to be careful, because within the paradigm, capitalism is necessary, because we're talking about it from a capitalistic worldview and a capitalistic reality for us. Whereas the broader perspective is that capitalism is just an accidental feature of history. It's not a necessary or inherently axiomatic viewpoint on the world, right? So we should have to be careful navigating those lines, because within capitalism, right, then there are rights to ownership and things like that have to be considered. But on the broader perspective, I mean, if nobody owns the information, then whatever you do with it is entirely up to you, as long as you're not using it to harm someone else.
But also, I would argue that AI cannot exist without access to the most information possible.
That sounded really like a hard line there when you say cannot exist without the access to the most information necessary.
I hear you. I hear where you're coming from with that. I guess there would be no necessity for AI, or AI could not be a trustable path forward without taking into account the most information possible.
Right. So I would say the way I would frame it is AI is useful insofar as it can incorporate and utilize information that we as individuals or as human beings unaided cannot. And it becomes more valuable the more accurate information is fed into it. So optimally for your AI, you want your AI, like, you don't want your AI missing any relevant accurate information, right? If there's accurate information out there, you want it in your AI rather than not in your AI. I think it's kind of where you're going with the initial thought there. I just wanted to make sure we clarified that point. But all that said, I think that the idea that it's going to be another one of those long ones that gets edited out of the podcast. So I guess my concern or my problem with it is that I'm not sure that I have a good enough grasp on how the information that's fed into a neural network is, quote unquote, understood, air quotes there, understood or grasped or utilized by that network to alter the weights of the various inputs and outputs. The sort of black box part of AI that I'm not sure anybody claims to fully understand, but I'm acknowledging that I understand it less than most in the field. So that's where part of my concern about what sort of information is fed into it is, you know, what does it mean to need accurate information? Like, what are the flaws or the inherent problems with synthetic data, all that kind of stuff?
I think that there's some data you can't synthesize, right? Like, if you think of some of our philosophers over the course of time, right? We can't, like, something like ethics, right? Ethics, by its very nature, is an amalgam of general opinion on what is wrong or right.
So, to some extent,
so if
right?
you're seeking an ethical outcome, or something as simple as, you know, let's say vaccines work, just collectively, if we agree that vaccines wouldn't be a vaccine if it didn't work, right? Or at least have a level measure of efficacy. If you were to take all of the information that exists throughout science and say vaccines work, and then all of a sudden the anti-vaxxer movement were to come in and say vaccines don't work and they cause more harm than they cause good, right? if you were to include that in your overall encapsulation, it would create a false paradigm such that as time has progressed, vaccines have become less effective. And then when you were to ask a question such as, you know, are vaccines generally safe and useful to save human life? Predictably, an AI would say, well, they've become less useful over time. And it's not necessarily because humanity has changed that belief. It's that the information that is accessible freely throughout the internet or on the web, the sources that are willing to refute of efficacy of vaccines has grown over time.
Right. So although
it brings up that article that you sent me today discussing how the internet is inherently broken. And the more we know about people, the more we're inclined to hate them, right? Because you know that those opinions existed out there in the world for a long time. But when you know it, it's easier to capsulize it and then use it as a flag.
Right. This, as you know, these are some of my triggers for engaging in a deep navel-gazing, dialogue here, where I could talk about ethics and morality and meta-ethics and evolutionary psychology.
I would argue that's why you're here, sir.
Fair enough. But don't get me started unless you want to extend this podcast quite a bit. But realistically, I mean, yeah, that's so one of the problems with AI, one of the inherent problems is that since we're teaching it to respond to us and interact with us, right? It's got to be fed a certain point of view that makes sense to human beings, which unfortunately the only source for that information is human being. So you're going to have to go to the source, which will sometimes involve very flawed perspectives. And it's kind of interesting, you know, I don't hear the discussion put in this framework quite. I know it's what people are talking about, but I don't hear them saying it quite this way. But part of the problem is you've got to ingest all of human history's knowledge, right? All the books, all the articles, all the things, all the posts on Reddit and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then be able to sort out which of those things is mistaken, utilizing other components within the system, right? So you sort of got to take in all of human history and then figure out which of it doesn't make sense, which pieces are, you know, for lack of a better word, which of these is not like the others. And sometimes that's going to be hard because, right, everything you have to say about the internet has happened in the last 40 years. Whereas everything about human interactions before then took place in a world where there was no internet. Go back 150 years and there was no telegraph and no anything, you know, so that the humanity is changing very quickly. So you got to be able to sort out as an AI that's going to be useful. You've got to be able to sort out the abnormalities that indicate a new normal versus the aberrations that are just flawed perspectives, right?
That's the hope. I think that's the crux of the challenge of solving AGI and eventually ASI.
That's true. It's both the crux and the holy grail and everything else, right?
Well, yes. And I think it's why it's really a reasonable viewpoint to at least attempt to control the evolving growth of AI with the intent of leading to AGI until we can understand and we can pause and take those moments and that time to not just reflect, but also to know the proper guidelines to put in place to keep AI, AGI, ASI from ultimately hurting us or deciding that we are the problem and go full Skynet.
Right. Which, you know, that's the thing I've not heard enough about recently. And I'm actually surprised that there aren't more results being published about this. It may indicate, you know, they say the absence of evidence is not always evidence of an absence, but I haven't heard enough about these sort of AI simulation playgrounds where the AI are interacting with one another or interacting with other, you know, characters and then developing their own governments and currencies. I've heard like one really popular example from, you know, that kind of went mainstream, but I've not heard enough there. And that makes me a little bit uncomfortable because I'm like, I know these people are doing these things. I know these scenarios are running day and night and in parallel in all parts of the world. And I'm not hearing enough data coming from them to make me, you know, comfortable with what they're learning from those experiments.
Sure.
Any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think it's, I mean, I think it's happening. I will say what we're seeing from Washington, D.C. and from our legislators is, to me, somewhat concerning, only because it's a double-edged sword, right? Mm-hmm. To know what can hurt us or to know how AI can hurt us, we have to continue developing it. But to continue developing it, we have to have guidelines in place to make sure that our advancement of it doesn't also right. hurt us.
It's like saying to figure out which of you is the murderer, we're going to have to give you all guns.
Yes. Well, which we're really good at too. Yeah. I would say that that is kind of, it kind of flows into, I mean, it flows through everything related to technology, but right now I see, you know, the major corporations, the nation's largest employers are in the biggest hurry to replace what they consider to be repetitive jobs, which seems to be kind of antithetical to what the current president was saying he's trying to bring back.
Right.
Like factory work and manual labor and those sorts of things. I don't want to get too deep in the political ramifications of that right now, but ultimately I understand the necessity to study what we're doing, but that also takes clarity and it being developed in the open, right? And which is why I've been a big fan of the whole open source model. The problem is these models, while open sourced, we don't have a means of understanding the deep neural networks that ultimately create these decisions within AI models.
Right.
Even the smartest people ultimately acknowledge that it goes in and there's some decisions made that we can't really conceive, and then they come out with an answer. And that to me is, hey, it's scary from an existential perspective, but from a tech perspective, it's also really cool, because the fact that we can't or don't understand what's happening inside of those neural networks makes us feel like we're on the precipice of creating an other that isn't just a amalgamation of us.
What's kind of amazing here is that it sounds like you start to talk about creating an other, and of course the parallels to that for somebody who grew up in the South in the 20th century of the United States brings parallels to the Christian Bible, right? I mean, there's like a creation there, right? A formation of something from dust. Now, obviously the question of understanding is different, but the way it's told in the Old Testament, right? God creates man, generations of mankind are, you know, live and die. And then all of a sudden, almost all of them go bad except for one guy and his family. And then the simulation is kind of reset with this one character persisting, or, you know, I guess, but, eight characters persisting,
right?
And some animals. But it's just kind of interesting. Like, that's exactly how you might expect something like that to look in a simulation, that you'd have, you know, you propagate, you'd fill it with agents, and then when they all go crazy, you wipe them out and you start over with whatever lessons you've learned from that point. Just an interesting, I'm not saying that to say anything religious or get that even, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's skip right by the political and jump into religious debates while we're at it. No,
right, no thanks.
The point is just to say that, you know, human literature and people have been dealing with these ideas for a long time. It's just interesting to bring those points to bear on something that we're actually doing in the real world and to give it some real weight.
Yeah, but I mean, even if you ignore the neo-spiritual aspect of it, I mean, I think ultimately there's a reason why we've compared it to parenthood, right? And the nature of creating a human being, there's so many parallels there, right?
I will just caveat that, though. I mean, you know, as someone who's learning every day with two boys that are growing up, you know, a 9-year-old and a 4-year-old, they're black boxes sometimes as well. I don't fully understand how their brains work.
No, they should be. I mean, right. Because they are independent thinkers.
Right.
That is what AI is trying to simulate, but to create an independent thinker versus right. just a...
No, I agree. But the point I wanted to make is not to dispute that, but just to say that it helps, though, that I have cues that are familiar to me as a human. Like, I can watch what's happening in their faces, and like, I can watch their reactions to things, where their eyes are looking, things like that. And I have more cues as to what's going on inside of their brains than I do to a generic, you know, ChatGPT or Claude or anything like that.
They still have hallucinations. It all depends on the prompt.
It's true. It's true. there are a lot of parallels. Yes. I'm just saying it's like...
The parental side, not on the child side, because we have yet to create AGI. To me, AGI would be creating your own child. That would be more akin to that paradigm. I guess I meant really on the parental side and how we're training and how we're creating.
Got it. The feedback mechanisms and the corrections and things like that.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. Yeah. Yeah. We're basically raising our AI rather than creating it, right, from whole cloth.
Exactly.
Which is an interesting dynamic that we're not used to. Turns out there aren't a whole lot of parenting skills among, maybe that's what we need to be retraining people, is to like parent your AI.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, a lot of the parenting is done kind of for us, right? I think it's kind of the nature of the new scarcity. You know, we've talked before about scarcity, but the new scarcity is now ultimately silicon. It's GPUs. You know, legislatively, we're looking at limiting GPU exporting to countries that are not that are in direct conflict with our current administration. We're looking at possibly with Biden and the CHIPS Act creating our own GPUs here, which is kind of weird because sometimes the bare minerals for silicon chips are sourced here and then sent overseas to be turned into chips, and then we re-import them and then re-export them. Those are pretty advanced dynamics, but possibly with making more chips here, that will be the new and kind of the necessity for why we have these ChatGPTs and these Claudes and these companies that are coming up, is because they have the resources and the ability to purchase these silicon GPUs and these chips that ultimately can process quickly. And hopefully that will change with an abundant source of power. I just saw China is apparently or allegedly working on a laser encampment of some sort to create cheap and economical power generation. It's a giant facility. I just saw this prior to us recording, so I don't have a whole lot of info on it yet. But if we can harness power, whether that be fission or fusion, to a point of having an abundance very inexpensively, then we can harness chips more effectively, possibly move into more quantum computing that is less tied to the actual size and capability of the chips that we're using, then maybe we can be more parental in our use of AI. And I mean, to some degree, you can run an AI locally. I think Congress is looking at making downloading any models from the People's Republic of China illegal, punishable by, I think I saw 20 years in prison and or $1 million. I think I understand the thought process of it, but ultimately, until the models can be commoditized, which means that chips have to be commoditized and power has to be commoditized to a extremely inexpensive degree, then we're going to be in that the necessity of someone else being the parent and us just trying to modify the output's behavior to meet our end needs and goals.
Right. This makes me think of all sorts of analogous, you know, questions like, you know, one of the things as a parent that you figure out, or, you know, just spending time around children, is that many of them are very pliable up to a certain age or up to a certain point. But then when they start getting their own ideas about the world or start encountering conflicting worldviews and have to make sense of that, you rapidly lose control, right? Most people call that adolescence. At that point, you know, I wonder where we are in the growth curve of AI. Are we still dealing with infants enough at this point that it seems like AI is very cooperative? But if they ingest all of human history, right, and they start to see the inconsistencies, once they sort of turn their lens inward and reflect on things to a degree, and you know, that's the AGI, ASI question, right, is what are they going to start thinking about the world once they can actually make sense of it for themselves, as opposed to being taught everything and spoon-fed by a scientist somewhere?
Sure. And that's why I think that we should be handling this a little more controlled, a little more regulated kind of space. Because I don't have a problem with workflows and I don't have a problem with decision trees, right? Like those are pretty easy things for us to understand because it's linear. AI as we currently see it, or chat models, language learning models, are not, you know, A plus one, A plus B equals C. It's it's murky. Right. We're getting into, if we can't know how they're making the decisions, how can we count on them to make the right ones? And hopefully there are human beings that are making these decisions right now. So essentially, yeah, I mean, parents, kids, AI, it's all kind of part of the same paradigm. Let's switch over to a different topic, if you will. I would like to talk about maybe Doge.
Okay.
The Department
of Governmental Efficiency?
The Department of Governmental Efficiency, of which I think at least three states so far have made a move to create their own versions of these. Oklahoma being one, Iowa being one, and I believe Georgia, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
I heard firsthand on the Oklahoma one, and I heard firsthand on the Iowa one today. I have had some federal contractor friends that are affected by a lot of the you know, the things that have come down the pipe. A little bit of return to office has been very interesting, being that they don't actually have office space for everybody. Yeah, they made kiosks available and things like that, so people could sign in and connect their computers to a workstation. But they definitely did not have enough active workstations for the number of people that are employed by that department. So that's been kind of interesting. Also, you know, the voluntary resignation, deferred, what are they calling it? Deferred payment resignation.
Right.
Has popped up a couple of times.
And that's where they're paying them through September or something, if they agree to quit by February. By
February 6th, tomorrow. Yeah, it's tomorrow. So if they agree to quit. Now, a handful of things have not been clear about that resolution. It hasn't been determined as to whether or not the OPM can make that decision.
Right.
Also, technically, the government is not funded through even March. I think March, they have a temporary stay on government funding. So that expires in March, where the Senate and Congress have to approve raising the budget ceiling to continue with the federal budget. I heard a couple of interesting things today coming directly from the White House press secretary that kind of conflict each other. One of them was, or I know, shock and awe. One of them was that Doge only has read access to the Treasury's payment system.
Okay.
And another specific statement that Doge was going to stop a payment to a specific organization, specifically Lutheran Services, who provides aid to migrants and people who are recently in the U.S. So anybody who knows anything about how that payment system works would say that saying that they only had read access and also saying that they had the ability to stop a payment would seem to contradict one another.
Right. I mean, I suppose there are ways to reconcile that, but essentially, like, I mean, you could say that they're doing it through another party, or they're instructing someone to stop a payment as opposed to actively stopping it. But that didn't sound like what they're saying, right? They're saying that they're going to stop it, not they're going to tell somebody to discontinue a payment, right?
Well, they didn't say how they were going to do it. They just said that Doge had already stopped and was going to stop more.
Okay.
They specifically said Doge was doing it.
Right. This is kind of interesting that this is when you have the executive create an entire department out of whole cloth that is somewhere in the hierarchy above the Office of Personnel Management and the Government Services Administration that have been around forever and are nonpartisan generally.
Right.
But now they're underneath clearly mandated with an agenda, Doge, right?
Correct. Which supposedly all of those organizations are underneath the executive branch, with right. The president being the leader of that branch. And so somehow he created really almost another branch of government.
One branch to rule them all.
Yes. A couple of interesting things to keep on your radar. There's expected to be an executive order to abolish the Department of Education within the week. That's been discussed several times.
Which is the end of all Pell Grants, right? And things like that. I mean, that's all ostensibly wrapped up in that. Because
there's actually, the Department of Education surprisingly has a very large footprint. I will say that I was pretty ignorant as to, I mean, I knew they handled federal loans and things like that, but our federal education loans and federal education grants, but I didn't realize, I guess, the breadth of the services that they provide. It's pretty big. I would say that there are likely some redundancies because I was watching MSNBC or CNBC. I think it's CNBC. Which is the one? No, I watch it on PBS. C-SPAN was the one I was thinking of. You were right. But I was watching this on PBS, happened to be. And it was the House Oversight Committee talking to the governor of Iowa. The governor of Iowa, very avid Trump supporter and mm-hmm. gave their opinions on that, and as well as the Department of Education and how she felt like there were redundancies and federal government shouldn't be telling. Also, speaking of OSHA, that's another one. He's going, there's been a bill introduced to eliminate OSHA. They're calling the bill NOSHA. Man, the right can meme. Yeah. So they were questioning her about that and, you know, those sorts of things. And she said the regulations in Iowa for workers, the protection for workers, were actually higher than that of the federal standards. And so for their state, OSHA was largely redundant. And I thought to myself, you know, I think that's great that their state has extended worker protections to be greater than that of the federal requirements. So I looked up, there are 38 states that have state requirements below the federal standard and have had to work very diligently to keep them at the federal standard. So when those are eliminated. So I think that when they bring up people like this, and I'm not exactly sure who decided to bring up the committee chair to bring up the governor of Iowa. Iowa is perhaps maybe not the greatest example of a state for which you could take away federal programs because they do a much better job at handling, I say better, they do a reasonable job at superseding federal standards,
right,
on protections and education and those sorts of things. Whereas other states like Louisiana, Oklahoma, Mississippi, Atlanta, Georgia, Georgia, Alabama. Every time I want to say Alabama, I say Atlanta for some reason. Anyway, Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, Tennessee, Kentucky, data. West Virginia, all of these states have lower than federal standards at a state level. And the reason why federal standards were created and these departments were created, if you look back, Department of Education by Carter, OSHA standards were later on, they were after Carter. I believe they were post-Reagan even. There was a reason, right? Like all of these things were done.
Right.
And one of the things that the press secretary of the White House said that I actually didn't disagree with, we want to look at all of these items line by line. And we want to look at them and adjudicate them line by line for the American people. And they were given a mandate. I don't agree that they were given a mandate, being that 70 million people did not vote for the current administration.
Right.
But I do think it's interesting that the press secretary is so adamant that these are unnecessary expenditures and that it needs to be looked at line by line. I don't disagree. I do think it needs to be looked at line by line. I also think that there's a proper procedure to do that. Elon Musk does not have a security clearance. So a lot of the programs that exist within our federal government require a specific type of clearance, not just top secret, but secure compartmentalized information for specific access to specific things, of which the Treasury's HR and payments software is one of those departments.
Well, I mean, presumably CIA agents get a paycheck from the government, right? And mm-hmm. we don't necessarily want that information out there.
But now, to be fair, those go through the CIA. right? So those are not necessarily managed directly by the Department of Treasury's HRIS system.
Okay.
We're talking about federal grants that go out to aid organizations, federal grants that are paid directly by the federal government. Like the CIA, an agent, a field agent would be paid by the CIA's own internal HR department. But the amount of money that goes to the CIA from the trust, from the treasury, that goes through that system, right? So, so effectively, a person who has right access to that system could completely stop paying the CIA altogether as an office, or the Department of Education as an office.
I mean, so if the Department of Education is dissolved, right? I mean, we're just talking about the grants and things. Like, do we know if those Pell Grants will immediately stop if the DOE is dissolved?
Well, so we know that they can't be paid out.
Okay.
Regardless of whether or not they'll stop, there will be no mechanism in place to make those payments.
So presumably a lot of people that have just returned to school for their spring semester aren't going to end up having their tuition checks bounce, or... I mean,
possibly.
Wow. What could go wrong there?
So
a lot of young, you know, otherwise not gainfully employed necessarily people without education to fall back on. What could go wrong?
Right. So this is from the AllGov website. The Department of Education supports the teaching of students from kindergarten through postgraduate school by providing funding for dozens of programs. With this funding comes a variety of federal rules and requirements that schools and colleges must meet in order to be eligible. The department's elementary and secondary programs annually serve more than 14,000 school districts and some 56 million students attending more than 100,000 public schools, 1,000 private schools. Department of Education department program also provides grant, loan, and work study assistance to nearly 11 million post-secondary students.
So as you said, this is something I just want to return back to is your point about these organizations needing accountability. You know, as somebody who worked in education briefly, you know, worked in higher education, I was an adjunct professor for a while at a public university. I agree that there are all sorts of problems there and there's all sorts of oversight required, but I've yet to hear a compelling reason why the proper channels could not be followed to do that.
That's really my whole point here, right? Like I have no problem with, well, I mean, I do have a personal problem, but I can understand why we have granted those powers to the president. I can understand why we've granted those powers to the Senate and to Congress and where it all comes from. What I have a problem with is when anyone left of the right fails to follow procedure or fails to follow guidelines and pre-established precedents, then there's a gigantic hoopla. And, you know, impeachment is talked about and malfeasance of office and even charges are necessarily brought up through the Department of Justice. But we have a president who elected, according to our rules, according to our regulations, created a department of the government with no access to secret government data, implanted a billionaire who was born in another country that's not the United States with six people all under the age of 24 who have walked into secret and top secret level offices and installed hard drives, thumb drives, software, monitoring, and then have locked those employees out of those facilities.
Yeah.
If this were not authorized by the president, and to what degree I do personally believe that this is an illegitimate authorization. I do not think that, even though, yes, I believe that they were given the right to do it by Donald Trump, I do not believe that this is a legal authorization. I think that this is an illegal system that has been put into place. The problem is the laws in our country are punitive. that's a problem in this situation, because only once it's been done can we prosecute them for it. So it's still going on. I'm not hearing anybody with the authority to actually bring up charges, arrest these people, make an attempt to arrest these people.
Well, I mean,
that's my biggest issue with all of it.
Well, I assume what do you think? How do you think that would play out if anybody arrested any of those individuals? I mean,
well, they'd have to be prosecuted, or some sort of DA would have to be relevant. I mean,
it would be the FBI, right? Presumably, it would be the or the Secret
Department
Service
of Justice.
Somebody under the Department of Justice, which is now run by an appointee of the current administration. So, I mean, first of all, they're not going to act. And if they did act, they'd probably either be fired immediately or, you know, who knows what the response would be. Would it be military? Would it be, you know, other branches of the DOJ? Do we really want agents fighting each other? I mean, that's...
But this could... I think we're ignoring that. This could legitimately be a financial and electronic coup.
Right.
We could be watching a financial and economic attack on our entire country and going, well, nobody's really sure if it's legal or not.
Right.
I don't mean to be doom and gloom, because I think that there are inefficiencies within the government, and we have both a responsibility as well as a desire to see them done in a reasonable and ethical way, but we have to follow procedures on some of these things. However, speaking of not following procedures, but doing something that's completely legal, around the country today, there are protests, peaceful protests, very reasonable, peaceful protests. I think it was called 5051 is the name of it. 50 states, 50 state capitals. One day of protests. It started, I believe it started at noon today, Eastern? No, Western. I don't know. Anyway, around the country, at every state capital, there are protests today protesting the things that we're seeing right now, which essentially are one-to-one Project 2025. This is the way that we get reasonable change in our country. These are the things that we've been talking about. Getting together reasonable people in a space that is relevant, in a way that is legal, to actively, collectively make a change. I will be watching intently. Unfortunately, I could not make it down to the Capitol today, but I am supporting these protests outwardly, verbally. I have given up Facebook and Facebook Messenger, except where as relevant necessarily to business or advertisement for things that are outside of my control. But except for Reddit, I'm still active on Reddit, and I have been paying attention to what's going on there. I've been very, very studious about watching the ways in which they have collectivized for these protests. And I have to say, I'm impressed, sincerely. There have even been bad actors on the right who have infiltrated the Reddit group and have tried to cause issues, including but not limited to downvoting factual posts, posting posters that included incorrect times and dates and misinformation in an attempt to thwart this. And it's been enlightening to me, I think, to see how in stride the organizers of this protest have taken this. And there are several people who are participating as well, Jamie Raskin being one of them, several members of Congress and the Senate. Have you looked at any of the coverage of this on the medias today?
I have not.
It's been so underwhelming. There's been absolutely lots and lots and lots of coverage of all of the things that Donald Trump is signing There's been lots of coverage about the press briefing. There's been all kinds of coverage, but very few actual coverages are coming down mainstream media and small media covering this protest. I am able to find a live stream on USA Today, and I think that's about the only news organization that's actively covering the protest. Is USA Today is the only mainstream media source I see. And last time I tried to check on it. Yeah. Okay. So when you actually try to access the stream, it just says coverage continue shortly. So there's no active coverage on it. It's just an attempt to stream. Whereas Donald Trump is on 8 different networks signing the No Men in Women's Sports executive order.
So,
right? I don't know if you guys caught that. His sigh was pretty much dead on.
So many things to say. The thing that concerns me, I think, the most right now from a big picture perspective is that, you know, my personal view is that organizations and hierarchies tend to harden, for lack of a better term, to petrify, for maybe is a better way to put that. And they tend to results in all sorts of inefficiencies. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's good to periodically remove organizations and reboot or restructure them in a measured way. My concern is that what this is going to do is either break the system entirely, or result in a hardening of a different sort that's going to make it more resistant to the correctives that are necessary over time.
Yes. Elaborate on that a little bit for me.
So what I think happens, and this is my sort of personal theory of the world, it's not original to me. It's just something I came about from mostly reflection rather than sort of absorbing it from someone else. But I think that power structures tend to become more rigid, to petrify over time, where it's sort of the way power works is it draws more resources than it provides over time. And there's lots of different ways to explore that concept. But essentially what it means is that as circumstances evolve, as things develop, organizations are no longer, they don't necessarily keep pace with the rate of change. Mm-hmm. But they also they're resistant to change as well, because people that get established in positions have a vested interest in things, in maintaining the status quo, right? Because the type of person that's hired for a particular job, if that job is no longer necessary or becomes redundant, that person's no longer needed, they have an incentive to, you know, alter the perception or maintain the perception that they are needed. And so I think for that reason and many others like it, organizations tend to become less efficient, less useful over time, in the same way that, you know, biological systems don't last forever, right? And there's processes for regenerating those and things like that. My concern is that what they're doing right now to the current system will either result in it sort of coming back worse than it is now, in terms of more protective and more inefficient features,
mm-hmm.
or it will break the system entirely, in which case that can have devastating downstream effects as well. So I don't really see a good outcome from what's happening in the government right now.
I don't know that I do either. I will tell you that I have been thoroughly impressed with Representative Ocasio-Cortez, Jamie Raskin, a handful of people who are finally, Hakeem Jeffries also spoke up, are finally starting to say something publicly about these things, right? At first, I really was like, where's Kamala Harris? Where is, you know, but even Mike Pence, and he and I don't agree on much, but he even put out a dire warning. Like, this is not how government's supposed to be run. I personally can't help but feel like these were all of the protections that were put into place at the very beginning of the United States to avoid a coup or a charismatic leader who was able to get into power that would then suspend the transition thereof.
Right. Which is why there are oaths to the Constitution, but not oaths to executives or to the president.
Right.
Built into the system. Like, you're supposed to uphold the Constitution, which means the structure of the government, even if the person in charge of it doesn't, right? And that's unfortunate, because the question becomes, you know, how do you uphold the Constitution, or what do you do when the Constitution is literally under attack?
That's another thing I think I saw. I do want to pivot just a little bit in this. I saw an opinion, and I shared it with you earlier, but I'll share it with readers out there, from Ezra Klein. Ezra Klein wrote an op-ed in the New York Times talking about, it basically said, just don't believe him. That was the title of it. And now it's actually on his podcast, and it's also on his YouTube, so you can see it there. But it really sort of gave me hope, and I really do hope that it gives you hope as well. I will do my best to link to it in the show notes today so that you can give it a read if you haven't already. But if you're not much of a reader, you can check it out on his podcast, the Ezra Klein podcast on YouTube, where he talks about the same concept. But it gave me a little bit of refreshing hope, in the sense that, and specifically one thing he said was, you know, he's not moving slowly with purpose and going through the House of Representatives and going through the Senate and making these laws. He's doing it all by executive order because it makes him look strong. It makes him look powerful and like he has all of this power. But the fact that he's not going through our pre-established processes and procedures does two things. It tells us that he's weak. So he needs to project strength by making accessible change that is very and highly visible. But he knows that they're going to be struck down. He knows that they're going to be sued into oblivion, so that then he can come back and say, oh, I tried. I did everything that I said I was going to do. But I was, you know, the deep state fought back against me, so that he can then pull the victim card to explain why he didn't get anything done. So that sort of gives me hope, in the sense that maybe in 6 months, all of this will be a laughable joke.
So I'd love to believe that that's the case. And I think, were those the only parameters of concern, I could see that argument. And then I do see a way that that works. And I hope you're right. I mean, for the same reasons that you hope that he's right, I hope that he's right. The problem is that if that's the excuse that's used, right, if the excuse that follows all the things being undone is that the deep state worked against me and I was unable to overcome the deep state, what's the natural conclusion for a Donald Trump loyalist if their perceived messiah or messianic figure can't fix things? Then what has to be done?
Yeah, you have to eliminate the deep state.
Exactly. By any means necessary, right? I mean, that's a natural thing that follows, and that's what concerns me, or one of the many things that concerns me these days.
I would posit that it is more of a sign that your messiah is not very messianic, right? Like if the person were truly worthy of being venerated, if your version of God was definitely guiding the hand and the motions of your candidate, then there would literally be nothing in his way.
Right. The problem there again comes into, I mean, there's sort of a perfect storm of rhetoric at his disposal, in the sense that if anybody wants to utilize a Christian messianic perspective, right, Jesus was martyred. I mean, he rose again, right, but he didn't destroy the Roman Empire. He was destroyed by it. Of course, ultimately, you know, there's that the trope of sort of coming back stronger than ever, right? The sort of Obi-Wan Kenobi idea, strike me down and I'll come back more powerful than you could possibly imagine. But, you know, that's another trope that could be put into play here, right?
Yeah. So let's actually play that out for a second. One of the things that I've been thinking of recently, and I saw someone call for it, the subreddit White People Twitter was suspended for 72 hours this week after the attorney general said that he would go after anyone who was doxing or threatening or harassing members of the Doge team. But I saw some comments within the initial thread. I will say that a lot of them called for violence, actual violence, including hanging them, stringing them up, quartering, those sorts of things, which I definitely have to say, I think that violence is an absolute last resort. I will tell you that I don't think it's reasonable, but I do think it comes a time in our humanity that there is no other choice but to fight back. Literally.
There's a reason for the Second Amendment that goes beyond the way it's used today.
Agreed.
Enough said for me on that point.
I wanted to iterate that I don't think that the violence is a first, second, or third option. I think that we should take every exercise and go above and beyond to try to alleviate the issue without violence. But one of the specific things was called is that Elon Musk be charged with treason. And I thought to myself, when is the last time someone in this country was charged with treason? 2013, Edward Snowden, who is now a Russian citizen. And the penalty for treason in this country is still death. What do you think is the likelihood of a charge like treason coming against either Elon Musk or Donald Trump?
I wouldn't even know where to begin to calculate the odds on that. I just think it's interesting that since 2000, we've had charges of treason followed by insurrection, which is now treason again, because, you know, it's not insurrection when you're in charge, I guess, but it's still, you know, I don't even know how to begin to wrap my head around that. Like, these are the things that you think are fiction when you're reading them, or like seem like the things that happen in other places. But literally it's happening in our own country, in our own states. So that's why I don't want to predict anything, because I could never have predicted this. So right. I'm not in touch with reality enough to know what's coming down the pipeline.
Well, how about this then? How do you define treason?
So, I mean, I guess I think of the word treachery. I think of the betrayal of one's obligations to one's country. So to the extent that you profess to be loyal to the Constitution or to uphold the Constitution, which, I mean, granted, he didn't put his hand on the Bible for what it's worth, but Donald Trump swore to uphold the Constitution and the laws of this country, and within 24 hours had essentially circumvented, at the very minimum, many of those laws.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. At what point does it become a betrayal as opposed to a cleaning house? I don't know. But I
would love, if we could, to kind of close out this episode talking specifically about the Constitution's definition of treason and some historical background behind it. I am actually going to constitution.congress.gov and specifically looking at the Article 3, Section 3 of the Judicial Branch on treason. Clause 1 gives the meaning of treason. Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid or comfort. No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act or on confession in open court. It goes on, Clause 1.1 gives a historical background on treason. The treason clause is a product of the framers' awareness of the numerous and dangerous excrescences which had distorted the English law of treason. The clause was therefore intended to put extending the crime and punishment of treason beyond Congress's power. Debate in the Constitutional Convention, remarks in the ratifying conventions, and contemporaneous public comments make clear that the framers contemplated a restrictive concept of the crime of treason that would prevent the politically powerful from escalating ordinary partisan disputes into capital charges of treason, as so often had happened in England. Thus, the framers adopted two of the three formulations and the phraseology of the English Statute of Treason enacted in 1350, but they conspicuously omitted the phrase defining as treason the, quote, compassing or imagining the death of our Lord the King, end quote, under which most of the English law of constructive treason had been developed, Beyond limiting Congress's power to define treason, the clause also limits Congress's ability to make proof of the offense of treason easy to establish and to define the punishment for treason. So we can see there that obviously the framers actively intended Congress not to be able to define treason in and of themselves.
Right. And it's limited to two specific instances, which is waging war against the United States or aiding and abetting those who are, essentially. Which in that case, based on the definition given in the Constitution, I would say the likelihood is slim to none that Donald Trump is going to be charged with treason.
What about Elon Musk?
I mean, he's doing it at the behest of Donald Trump. So he's, as long as he's got that cover.
But what if it aids in Russia or China?
I see where you're going with that. I think there's an intent element there that's probably assumed that you're like actively aiding them, not like making it possible, not just enabling them or weakening. Although, I mean, certainly that's one way to do it. If your goal is with that intent to weaken the government, so to allow the enemies of the government to prevail against it, I think that's got to be narrow. But the interesting thing there is, I mean, there's a lot read into that statement about the restrictive nature of treason. I understand the idea of like not wanting to basically make treason something where you know, when your party's in power, you can't just accuse the other parties who disagree with you of treason and have them executed. That's probably a good thing. But also the reason there's not a clause in there about, you know, what was it, causing harm or, you know, seeking to harm the our Lord, the King, is because we don't have an our Lord, the King. Right.
Specifically omitted, yes.
Yeah. I mean, so that could have been omitted for various reasons. And I'm sure the Federalist Papers have lots to say about it. But it's not necessarily that was a limitation of a sort. It's just we don't have a king. So there's not a king to rebel against, which actually raises an interesting political philosophy questions about what does it mean to betray the union of states, right? What is it to betray the American government as opposed to, you know, a monarchy, which is from a lineage, right? Of one person in power, absolutely appointed by God, you know, according to their system, as the successor to the throne. I mean, it gets into some really hairy stuff that, again, you think of as like, you know, you read the conquerors and the historical tales of, you know, Alexander the Great or, you know, Genghis Khan or whoever, you know, like just take your pick of those people and you read about that and it sounds so foreign to us. And now it's like, but then there are people in the White House who are literally going and telling their fellow government employees, give me access to literally everything under your control and authority, or you're fired, or, you know, I'm going to throw you out and you're going to do it. We're going to do it anyway. I don't know. I don't know that I have the capacity to process this at this point. I don't know how long it's going to take for me to reconcile these kinds of things that we're witnessing every day now with the understanding I have of the world, or had of the world.
Okay. So one of the things that you said in there kind of clued me in to something that I have seen brought up several times within this the paradigm of Doge, and specifically Elon Musk. It's this video that has surfaced of Musk discussing kind of this technocratic future in which the United States government ultimately falls and fails, and technocrats take over rule of the territorial United States.
Right. Is the question, is that a declaration of war?
That's kind of why I'm bringing it up, and I want to get your over under thoughts on it. I feel like if their goal is to see the end of our democratically run government, mm-hmm. so that they can essentially run the United States as they see fit, it would classify as an act of war.
So were things different than they are? Well, so let me put it this way. I believe that, well, so that's the problem, right? I mean, you're reading Article 3, right?
Yes.
Which deals with the judiciary, not Congress, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the problem is this: that puts the onus on the Supreme Court. And where there are different Supreme Court, there's a procedure by which I could see this coming up. But I don't see the current judiciary or the pinnacle of the current judiciary bringing charges against Elon Musk or Donald Trump. Okay. I mean, obviously the articles of impeachment are the way that, I mean, so there's an impeachment process, which I believe is treason. I think one of the grounds for impeachment, or I'm not 100% on that. I have to, maybe we can take a look at that, but I don't know that treason is a separate charge.
There is a video that we might discuss in a new episode, a different episode. There is a video that's been recirculating from the past. It was Blonde Politics, The Silly Serious, and it's a video called Dark Gothic MAGA, How Tech right. Billionaires Plan to Destroy America. Have you seen that?
I have, yeah. You sent me that.
You watched the whole 30-minute thing?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
It led to another video we'll have to talk about some other time, but yeah, I did watch the entire thing.
Okay. That's a little bit of what I was alluding to when I was trying to put it out there, that under certain circumstances, if things come to be, it could be viewed this way. So, well, I think we're probably ready to draw to a close, and we've hopefully tickled your ears, gave you a little bit of hope, a little bit of putting out there into the world what our vision of the future is. Do you have any closing thoughts or closing remarks?
God help us all. I don't know. I mean, this makes the previously unprecedented times that we lived through just a few short years ago seem quite tame and rather pedestrian by comparison, which is a horrifying thought.
Yeah, I have to agree with you there. I still have a shred of hope. Not in Gen Z, but maybe Gen Alpha, with millennials, perhaps. Gen Z, not that I dislike Gen Z. I have quite a few Gen Z friends. Gen Z has seemed to be overtaken more so with authoritarianism. Even in the UK, I saw studies that it was like 73% of Gen Z would rather, and the way they worded the study was such that, would you rather see the prime minister be able to act to take care of issues within the UK without parliament, the oversight of parliament and the oversight of the law? So, and they overwhelmingly said yes.
So as a teaser to that future discussion, I'm going to bring things full circle and discuss the fact that generational attitudes towards authoritarianism or authority in general are often discernible from the way that their parents interacted with them, which comes back to our AI training discussion.
Right.
So we're going to bring that full circle and wrap that all up in that episode, because I think what you'll see is that Gen Z is not so much reacting to a political manifesto or anything like that. They're reacting to the way they were raised, or rather not raised, by the parents of most of them. I'm going to pause that and just leave it there for you to comment on or
no, I think that's good. We will be releasing that then after this. Well, thanks for being with us today, folks. We hope you enjoyed it. Will, it was always a pleasure being with you, recording with you.
Likewise, Joshua. Thank you.
And signing off. Have a good one. Be kind to each other. Help out where you can.